This is the Sophia Mare Studios podcast.
A woman may read a Game of Thrones.
A woman may start a podcast.
Two women may host Podcasters Landing, the show devoted to the entire A Song of Ice and Fire series.
Two women may cover three chapters each week, followed by history and friendship lessons.
A listener may sit and tune in.
A woman may use adult language.
A woman may reveal spoilers.
A listener may support the show on our Patreon page at patreon.com/Sophia Mare Studios, all under case.
A woman welcomes a listener to Podcaster's Landing. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Nat.
And today we are covering A Game of Thrones. Eddard, Catelyn, and Sansa, all Starks. In these chapters, we meet Gendry.
Yay, we do, Gendry. Indeed. Yeah. Yeah, very exciting.
And Catelyn makes, like, the stupidest decision of her entire life.
Yeah, honestly, I was cringing. I was reading that. We'll get to it, but I was just, my teeth, you know when you cringe so hard that your teeth hurt?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what was happening.
And Sansa, we get the glamour of the tourney, which I like this chapter, particularly with, you know, the sort of interaction between Sansa and the Hound.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I really like that.
Yeah, but first, boring old Ned.
Yeah, he's not interested in the tourney. He's just, yeah.
He just does not care about it at all. And it's just funny that, you know, there's kind of describing basically, you know, what London looks like before a football match, or what any big American college campus looks like before football, basketball, or whatever match. Mm-hmm. Like, things have not changed all that much in regards to sports and spectacle.
Yeah, it reminds me, it takes me back to summer where we had the Euros, because it got delayed from last year. We had the Euros this year.
Mm-hmm.
And because England was in the final, I think it's been since since the World Cup. Since they won the World Cup, that's when they went to a major tournament final. Mm-hmm. And the streets were in absolute chaos. People were just destroying things. And I was just saying, that's why England doesn't deserve to win anything. because they just destroyed everything. They don't know how to lose and they don't know how to win. It's ridiculous. They're worse winners than losers.
And I think it's just very poignant that I'm reading Game of Thrones, you know, and we reached this part because just this week, Jess and I recorded the episode of, you know, the first task in the Triwizard Tournament.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So again, just we are getting lots of thematic similarities of sport and spectacle. And we were going into the deep, deep things of, you know, how we as a society, in our evolutionary psyche, we need violence, so we try to contain it in sport and spectacle so that it's not total anarchy.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, not here. There's always anarchy. Mm-hmm. Always anarchy.
Yeah. And in the US too. Oh my God, there are certain public health officials and like doctors and medical professionals. It's now getting to a point where a lot of them are quitting just because of the physical safety now, where people will like want to beat them up because
that's crazy,
because they don't want to accept the medical information that they're distributing.
You know what, that's insane. That's I don't blame them. It's just people are going crazy.
Yeah, like, but usually like it's just like that type of you know, fear as a medical or public health professional that was usually that type of, you know, fearing for your safety was typically reserved for, you know, naturally those doctors and whoever who provided abortions, because it's such a hot topic in the US. But now it's extended to other medical professionals just by, you know.
Yeah, to everyone
telling,
now.
Who are just, you know, telling the truth about the coronavirus.
Yeah. Well, not just the doctors as well, but other people, especially people who, well, I don't know about the doctors there. But the doctors here are definitely not well paid. Well, I guess in America they are because it is privatized. But the doctors here aren't very well paid. So it's just not fair for them to be abused like this. Mm-hmm. They're not getting paid that much. And it's a case of don't shoot the messenger, isn't it? It's just, people are just so crazy.
Yeah.
The world has gone mental.
Yes. Bonkers.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, things have not changed all that much from medieval times. People don't know how to win. People don't know how to lose. And they just go crazy. And Ned is contending with the fact that because of the spectacle of this tournament, for every knight that comes in, comes so many, like, you know, traveling minsters, prostitutes, you know, all sorts of things, you know, to get in on the action because of the tournament. Yeah. And there's been, like, so many riots, stabbings, a rape, and a woman's head was found in the river by the Sept.
Oh, it's exactly like London. Just a night out in London. Yay! I hate London. I went to London last week, and it stunk. And I was like, I don't want to come back here, but I have to go back next week.
Yeah,
for a work meeting, and I don't like it.
I, a few months ago, took a little mental health desperate weekend to Chicago because it's only 4 hours away from me.
Only 4 hours away.
Yeah, like compared to some people you've mentioned who cannot handle like 2 hours. And I'm like, you're on a tiny little island. Get over it.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And, you know, certain people are not speaking to me because of that.
It's been
a month now.
Oh, dear. Well, yeah, so I went to Chicago. And again, it was pleasant, you know, going to some of the museums and things like that. But definitely just reiterated that I do not enjoy big city life anymore. I like my quiet college town, working at a university. So I'm, you know, doing something I feel that is, you know, meaningful, like in education and things. But otherwise, yeah, like after Istanbul, I was just like, you know, no more. I want my quiet nature, feeding my semi-pet raccoons on the deck.
Yeah. So I, you know what, your raccoons give me life. But yeah, that's exactly it. It's just, I don't feel like we are regular 30-something-year-olds, because we're just, you know, I feel like a few years ago, people will still be going out in their 30s and will be like loving the nightlife and the city life. And me and you, I guess, we're just different because I want to get away from that as much as possible.
Yeah, because
as well as you.
Yeah, well, it gets to a point where the ambulance is going past your bedroom window at 4 a.m. with their sirens. It gets a little old.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know what? It was really weird coming from a town to just, from city like that, where I would hear sirens every night, to where I live now, even though it's not a village or anything, but it is quieter, and you almost don't hear anything. And it's crazy. It's quite difficult to sleep at first because you're just not used to being silent.
Yep. But anyway, so lots of riots and stuff because of the spectacle of the tournament. And Ned is just like, okay, Baelish, you're going to find some money to pay for like some extra, you know, security and, you know, people on at the city's watch. And he's like, I am. And he's just like, you got the money for this stupid tournament. You're gonna get the money to maintain the king's peace. Which I thought is epic.
Yeah. No, you know what? He has his priorities right. I think that although Ned resents this job and this responsibility that's been put upon him, I think he seems really that he's doing a really good job. Mm-hmm. And like I said, he gets his priorities right. And
yeah. He's good, again, you know, like me. I'm good at my job, but I'm not good at the interactions because some people are insane at my job, particularly certain people in power. So,
yeah.
Yeah, so I feel Ned, who just wants to do his job and people don't want to let him do his freaking job.
Yeah, yeah. You know what? I was in the same position as you with my old job. I liked my job and I could do my job. But, well, one person in particular I hated. I don't care. Mm-hmm. I don't care. She was my boss. I hated her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Ned's trying to keep, you know, the city from descending into complete chaos. Mm-hmm. And in between all of that, he does get a hand on the genealogy book that John Aaron was looking into before John Aaron passed away. And it's just, yeah, it just goes into all the histories of the major families. And I thought it was just interesting, the little clip of the Lannisters where an old family tracing their descent back to Lan the Clever, which just made me think of, the etymology that's given for the Potter name in Harry Potter was they were descendants from this one wizard who would help his muggle neighbors, and he was known as the Potterer, like, you know, the clay, mm-hmm. making pots with clay. And so it, hyphenated into Potter.
Yeah, a lot of names, old English names, it come from what they did before back in the day. So, Smith,
the son of all those things.
Yeah, I don't know. All my boyfriends, like, I think his surname is made up because his descendants are from Japan and his last name is not even remotely Japanese.
Oh.
So. It's very odd.
Did he purposely Anglophile his name?
He didn't. Maybe his granddad did.
Oh,
when he moved over.
Yeah, because again, racism prompts people to do that.
Oh yeah, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
But so we've got. Let's see. So also, he's looking into the book, and he's also like gone through the four. You know, people that were left in John Aaron's household, the people that Lysa Aaron did not take away, and he's really not getting anywhere with any of them.
Yeah, that's exactly what I wrote down in my notes. Like, he's just not having much luck with finding out about John Aaron's death and what caused it. No one's really
helpful. And I think Baelish knew that they wouldn't be helpful, but he just threw a bone to Ned just to gain his trust a little bit. To, like, mm-hmm. give the veneer of saying, oh, I am helping you, even though it was crap.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, sometimes you do have to, especially Littlefinger, you have mm-hmm. to trick people a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, give the false sense of security when you want something from them.
Mm-hmm. And we get a little bit in the sense of, you know, that Stannis and John Aaron were kind of talking to each other before mm-hmm. his death, and not long before he got sick, Stannis left for Dragonstone.
Yeah, yeah, and he's just not. But first of all, you know, they interviewed like three people. None of them were very helpful. But then this last person didn't seem like he was helpful. But at the end of the day, he was. Mm-hmm. So this last person said that that John Aaron and Stannis were hanging out a lot, and that also John has been quarreling with Robert as well, which is interesting because they were very close. But John Aaron was going mm-hmm. to send Robin, his son, to Dragonstone to be a ward of Stannis. That's what it looks like.
Yeah,
which is very different to what we found out in the beginning of the book, which is they were going to send Robin to
Tywin Lannister.
Tywin Lannister. So that's very interesting.
Yes, that is interesting. And it piques Ned's interest because he, of all people, knows that Stannis and Robert were not close. And so, like, kind of the triangle, you know, was John Aaron mm-hmm. as the father figure with Ned and Robert being at the Eyrie, you know, to get together as wards. And so the fact that John Aaron is, like, you know, suddenly getting buddy-buddy with Stannis, of all people, you know, mm-hmm. Ned finds a little bit, you know, interesting and, you know, out of place.
Yeah. It says here, Ned found it hard to imagine what could frighten Stannis Baratheon, who had once held Storm's End through a year of siege, surviving on rats and boot leather, while the Lords Tyrell and Redwyne sat outside with their host, banqueting inside of his walls. So it's just like nothing really would frighten Stannis that much that he would just leave.
Yeah.
And not come back.
Yeah, so a little bit of, you know, getting more questions than answers at this point. But it is a step in the right direction.
Yeah, yeah.
And who else? What do we got? Basically, you know, they tromp down from the Red Keep, the castle, towards the Mudgate, and they ultimately end up, well, basically, you know, Ned finds out that Stannis and Jon, or at least Jon Arryn, went to this, you know, blacksmith, you know, shop. And so he goes there and he's like, who was Jon Arryn talking to? And he's like, oh, he's talking to my apprentice, Gendry. And then we meet Gendry, which I love him.
Yeah. But you know what? As well, that Ned is still not, he still doesn't know the art of being subtle, because he's just, he wants to wear his, you know, his direwolf sigil in his like armor, and it's like, are you stupid? Well, he is stupid.
Yeah,
it's a rhetorical question.
Yeah, he's coming in the position of, I need to show my sigil and use all of my power as Hand of the King to like bulldoze through this investigation and get the information that I need and make sure no one is willing to withhold anything from me by exerting that power. But again, as Machiavelli said, sometimes you gotta be a lion, sometimes you gotta be the fox.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure that people know who he looks like, but anyway, he could have worn like some sort of a cape and...
Yeah, he could have done a Barristan Selmy with Daenerys for a while.
Yeah, exactly. He's so dumb. Ugh. I love the Starks, but fucking hell, they are so stupid.
Yeah, they're simple souls. And so I just think it's really cute that Gendry is like, no, it's my helm. It's my bullheaded helm. And, you know, and Ned is like, okay. And it finally clicks, you know, because he's looking at Gendry, his bright blue eyes, his super dark hair, you know, the fact that John was asking about his mother. And so Ned finally pieces it together. And I love the response of the, you know, the blacksmith, who is just like, who he was before is, it's not my business. He is my apprentice. That is who he is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, this guy is smarter than Ned in that regard.
Oh, absolutely. He's just like, you know, tight-lipped. He doesn't reveal anything, not even for like, I don't even think he would reveal it for Monday, really. Mm-hmm. Or he would, I don't know, but yep.
And so genealogy book, you know, inquiring about Rob Baratheon's bastards. So so Ned's starting to piece together, okay, it's something to do with Robert's offspring, but still hasn't, you know, figured it out. And it's interesting because in a modern audience, the idea of, oh, you're going to a bastard, oh, that, like, it's hard for us to understand that, you know, bastards were so commonplace amongst the nobility that for us, it immediately thinks, oh, of course he's looking at bastards because maybe the children aren't legitimate, so he's looking for other heirs. But Ned doesn't immediately presume that, and it's not because it's not that he's stupid, though he's stupid in other ways. It's just because that practice was just all over the place, and just the king having a bastard was nothing.
Yeah, I mean, he knows his friend. He knows he whores around. So, you know, so far it's not. Like you said, he's not piecing it together. He's just like, okay, there's one bastard here.
Mm-hmm. Because Robert probably, at least according to Maggie the Frog, Robert has like 20 kids.
Fucking hell. Yeah, I don't remember. Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yep. And thus we end our time with Ned, and we move on to Catelyn. what? I will admit, when I first read this, not so much this chapter itself, but it got really painful to go through the Tyrion chapters of him at the Eyrie. I was just not invested in this part of the story. Not because I have any shade on, you know, Tyrion's character or anything, but I'm just like, this is so freaking stupid.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, all results from an incredibly stupid woman. But yeah, it's all completely unnecessary. Just completely it's the start, isn't it? It's the start of things going downhill, and it's just you just want to jump into this book and hit that woman so hard in the mouth when she gets up and starts talking.
Yeah, and I don't know, when it first starts out, you know, it's pouring down rain in, you know, in the mud. You know, I can just, again, I used to ride horses, so I know exactly what she's describing in terms of the sucking noise of the hooves coming in and out of the mud.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's very
really cool.
That's a very vivid image for me.
Yeah. And... but, you know, she's once again glamorizing the South and criticizing the North. There's this passage here that says, the southern rain was soft and warm. Catelyn liked the feel of it on her face, gentle as a mother's kisses. Yeah, funny how she knows what a mother's kisses is, since she's not a good one in herself. It took her back to her childhood, to long gray days of River Run. She remembered the godswood, drooping branches heavy with moisture, and the sound of her brother's laughter as he chased her through piles of damp leaves. She remembered making mud pies with Liza, the weight of them, the mud slick and brown between her fingers. They had served them to Littlefinger, giggling, and he'd eaten so much mud he was sick for a week. How young they'd all been. Catelyn had almost forgotten. In the north, the rain felt cold and hard, and sometimes at night it turned to ice. It was as likely to kill a crop as nurture it, and it sent grown men running for the nearest shelter. There was no rain for little girls to play in.
Yeah. It's interesting because, again, you know, the North presents its own hardship, but even on the King's Road with Ned, Arya, and Sansa, you know, all those, like, swamps and bayous that they were going through in the sort of, like, closer to the River Run territory, like, you know, swamps, like, I personally think swamps are really ugly, and being in this specific region of the U.S., I'm getting really sick of humidity.
Right, yeah. I've never been to a swamp. Never seen a swamp, apart from Princess and the Frog. but yeah, it's just, like, the humidity and, like, just, it's just very boggy from what I can understand. It's just, it's not great, but she's like, oh, yeah, this is lovely. And it's like, girl, get a grip of yourself.
Not so much in these descriptions, but the fact that she's like, oh, why don't you go up to Winterfell? And the minstrel is like, you know, the Starks, like the music of the howling of their wolves. Like, basically, kind of the notion that, again, just in the North, they're not as cultured. Again, these sort of artisans and artists aren't willing to go all the way up there. And Catelyn doesn't rebuke him in any way, in terms of, like, the Starks are noble and honorable, like, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, no. That's why, like, she's just like, oh, my God. It's just like, stand by your house. You are not a Tully anymore. Just stand by your... I mean, am I being a bad feminist here?
I don't...
because you marry into a house, then that's your house and that's it. Forget about your family.
Not from my perspective, because people who throw a big stink about women who, like, change their last name, and it's like, but your last name, your birth name, is your father's. You're just trading one element of the patriarchy, your father, for another element, your husband. So what's the point?
So that is true. That is very true.
So yeah, I never perceive it that way. And again, it's hard to separate from the personal from the societal. It's just interesting in my situation. You know, for as patriarchal as Persian and Iranian society is, it is not traditional for women to take their husband's names. They just don't. Mm-hmm. And so me changing my name is more of a Western tradition, because there certainly wasn't any pressure on the Persian or Iranian side from my husband or his family to change my name, because they just don't do it. I just did it because I like presenting this unified front that we are the Sophia Mares.
Yeah, but the thing is, that's the thing. It's about being a unit together, and she's still not on board with that. She's still not on board with it. She's just, you know, still reminiscing about her days down south, even though it's been, I think she's lived there longer than she's lived with her parents. She's been there, how old is she, 25?
Well, my presumption for like Ned and like Catelyn and stuff, that they're all like 35, so it's been like 15 years because their oldest children are 15, and so that they were like 20, like 20 or like late teens when they got married.
Now, I think Ned is 35. Yeah, 35.
He's definitely
I think she's between 25 and 30. I don't think she's quite 30 yet. But if you think about it, she has been living there for longer than she lived down, you know, because she had to go up there when she was a teenager. It's like me, if I was glamorizing, I would never glamorize Brazil. But if I was glamorizing Brazil when I've been living here for 17 years, I was like, I don't know anything about that place anymore. So I shouldn't be. Right. And she pisses me off. But that's the thing. I don't know if I'm picking on her too much because I hate her, or if it's because that's what actually is going on in these chapters.
Like I'm personally trying to be like, since you hate her so much, I'm gonna try and be the devil's advocate, especially once we get out of Winterfell and out of her, like, you know, where her prejudice shines through when she's back in her element in Riverrun. But again, this you know, running across Tyrion Lannister and just seizing him.
Yeah.
I am confused by her acting in such a manner when she does not have concrete evidence, it's all more circumstantial. Mm-hmm. Not like the whole foundation of doing this is shaky at best. And even if she did had further proof, so blatantly thinking that like this is my only opportunity.
Yeah. Her husband lives in the freaking south. He lives where Tyrion like lives or goes there constantly. If anything, she could just like tell him.
Yeah, she could just like send a raven or send some sort of, you know, pay extra for like, you know, fast delivery. And tell Ned Tyrion is coming to King's Landing. Nab him when he comes there.
Yeah. She's just... anyway, we'll get to it. Let's just, you know, because there's this, like, the Malisters are riding down for the tourney. And she And Sir Roderick is like, put your cloak up. And she just doesn't do it. So I don't know if she's, like, if she's stupid or doesn't care about being recognized. I don't know what her issue is, but she's like, makes no move from putting her hood up. She's like, oh yeah, the mud will protect us from going in and like being recognized
I think I don't think she's that stupid in this case. I think she's correctly assuming that just by the nature of her clothes and her common dress, that even though she has the very stereotypical Tully hair, that the nobles are just going to see a muddy traveler on the road, and they're not going to think, oh, that's my Lord Hoster's daughter.
Yeah. She irks me. Sorry. But anyway, so then they get to the inn, and then the woman with the red teeth is there, and she offers them, I think, the last two rooms of the inn. They go in, they shower, clean, however, whatever they did those days. And then come down to eat. And because it was so crowded, no one really paid any attention to them. They go and sit, you know, with that singer. There's a bit here that, because she thought, you know, to one side I will go, I can go to River Run and talk to my father, but her father's sick, so she doesn't want to bother him. And then to the other side is the Eyrie where Lysa is, and you know, she's like, maybe I'll talk to Lysa, but she's like, yeah, there's the mountain road was perilous, and there's shadow cats. It's very dangerous to go there. And she only has, you know, one elderly knight with her, so she can't, you know, can't protect. They can't be protected. And she says no. She thought River Run and the Eyrie would have to wait. Her path ran north to Winterfell, where her sons and her duty were waiting for her. Which is funny. It's like nice to see that she's not completely stupid and recognize that she has things to do in Winterfell. That she has, you know, that she has a duty in Winterfell and stop playing. Well, that was before she that was before all of this.
That goes down. Yeah, that goes out the window very, very quickly. But yeah, so I'm just trying to think. Yeah, why would I travel to Winterfell? Marillion asked. It's all blizzards and bearskins up there, and the Starks know no music but the howling of wolves. Yeah, so yeah, also,
and like you
also
said before. Like you said before, she's just not defending it. She's just not saying anything.
No.
Actually, I think she has a smile for him.
Yeah, and she's throwing shade at the Mormonts with their bearskins.
Yep.
And who is to come in but Tyrion Lannister, who buys off one of the patrons, you know, to give up his room for a gold dragon.
Yeah, yeah. And he's like, yeah, I wouldn't require a large room, as you can see. So he arrives with two of his,
Yoren and, two, like, escorts.
Two of Lannister guards and then Yoren, who is coming down south to, but
he's the recruitment manager.
Yeah, the recruitment manager for the Night's Watch. So, you know, she's just like just watching him because she's like, oh, thank God that is, you know, that it is a crowded room and he won't see her. But then the stupid singer just, you know, just stands up and is like, oh, you know, where is this? Hang on. Oh yeah, my Lord of Lannister, I will be pleased to entertain you while you eat. Let me sing you the lay of your father's great victory at King's Landing, which attracts the attention of, you know, Tyrion. He says, nothing would be more likely to ruin my supper. And then he sees Catelyn, and he's like, Lady Stark, what an unexpected pleasure. And everyone's just like, the fuck? Because you wouldn't expect, you know, a lady down there.
Yeah, it's... You know, whether Tyrion would have believed her or not, it's unusual, but Catelyn could have thrown so many excuses out for why she was on the road.
But even though she tries to not be a Stark, she doesn't have... She is also not subtle, and she doesn't know how to lie.
Yeah, indeed. And, okay, so I was just surprised by Catelyn's, again, this is just from a modern perspective, not understanding, you know, the notions of loyalty between, like, bannermen and, you know, the lesser houses and things like that. But I just, if I were in Catelyn's position, even if I wanted to do something of this nature, for me coming back to my homeland, even though I haven't been here for 15 years, I would not trust the bannermen to just, in an instant... you know, come to my defense in such a way. I've been away too long.
100%. That's exactly what I thought. And that's what made me cringe so much. It's like, you are so stupid for putting on this complete ridiculous scene and being like, oh, you know, this person, your father is bannerman to my father and blah, blah, blah. You are so... ridiculous. Just stop.
So I'm just surprised that she thought it was gonna work, and I'm surprised for all the bannermen and everyone around her indulging her.
And
sometimes I wonder if specifically because it was a Lannister who don't have the best reputation in Riverrun and the North beyond, I'm wondering if it was less about, oh, of course we must do our, you know, duty to Catelyn Tully Stark, and more about, oh, we want any excuse to get a Lannister.
Yeah. I think it's more the latter than the first one, to be honest, because anyone could have been like, oh yeah, she can be just, you know, maybe she's not that person, because they don't really recognize her. So
yeah, what if it was a fellow like River Run Bannerman or a Northern Man or someone at the Vale? I don't see this going down that well.
No. She's just so ridiculous. I fucking hate her.
And also, anyway, again,
yeah.
And also, both being a Lannister and just, again, just the ableist society, that just his bastards were viewed as mm-hmm. evil and morally corrupt because of the nature of their birth. Likewise, Tyrion must also be, by nature, corruptible yeah. and evil because God cursed him with dwarfism.
Yeah, yeah. And the fact that he's clever as well. So if people really know about him, really know who he is, they would probably hate him as well, just because people don't like clever people because... and then they draw their swords and
she did not know what was more satisfying, the sound of a dozen swords drawn as one or the look on Tyrion Lannister's face. So mm-hmm. okay, again, this dumb decision, again, the foundation of her accusation is very unstable, very precarious. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. Even if she did have the evidence, this is not the way to go about it. Like, she's acting as if this is my only opportunity ever to get justice for my son. Which would make more sense if Ned did reject Robert's proposal and was staying in the north, and they were being like their sort of isolationist selves again. But her husband is in the capital now, mm-hmm. and... is the second most powerful man in the kingdom, technically, according to like the hierarchical flowchart.
Mm-hmm. I think that this as well pushed later on in the book Ned to take some of decisions that he wouldn't have taken if this didn't happen, because obviously word gets out, they down south knows what's going on, and then when Ned discovers, you know, about Joffrey and the rest. You know, he could have kept to himself a little bit and spoken to Robert privately, but I think this pushed his hand to
act
a bit faster.
Yeah, so, you know, we like to shit on Ned for all of his stupid decisions, but again, a lot of what he did was not of his own, like, initiative. A lot of it was reactionary to Catelyn doing this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I can only excuse this level of stupidity as, because I'm not a mother and I cannot imagine how I would feel if someone that I presumed to be my child's like attempted killer suddenly showed up, and even if it wasn't the smartest thing to do, like, I have the power right now because all my father's bannermen are here, I'm gonna do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In this case, you know, Catelyn should have taken a book out of Cersei. Be more like Cersei. Be calculating. She's just so ridiculous, so stupid. Ugh.
Yeah, just pay extra for the raven to get to King's Landing more quickly to tell Ned.
The secure raven. You
the
know?
Secure raven or the prime raven.
Yeah, where you go in and you have to sign for it. Yeah. Gets delivered exactly to mm-hmm. Ned.
Exactly. Don't even go, you upgrade to Harry Potter with an owl and get Hedwig.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Very trusty Hedwig.
Yeah, who already has that experience, you know, going to and fro with Sirius.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. No one ever found him, you see?
No one ever found him. So, yeah, very dumb decision, which, again, took me a long time to get through Tyrion's, like, arc in the first book because I just didn't like how stupid this was.
It's so painful. It's so painful to read.
Mm-hmm. Alrighty then, and now we move on to cute and delicate little Sansa.
If you say so.
No.
She's as annoying as her mother.
For now, but she has an excuse. She is a child.
Yeah, she's an impressionable child. We all know that it gets better for her. So
yeah,
not gonna be too horrible.
Yeah. So I really love this like tourney chapter because it shows, you know, this is like the event of the season of the year, and like, you know, this is like having VIP seating at like the club in Las Vegas and, you know, things like that.
I'm pretty sure it's like it's the Super Bowl ticket, because no one can get Super Bowl tickets unless you're like really rich. And
yeah, and the what is it, the, you know, like the Quidditch World Cup. Again, lots of parallels with the sports stuff, because I'm going through Goblet of Fire right now.
Yeah.
And I just found, I just made note of the fact that she was wearing green to match her hair, because I know green in like more like early Renaissance, like before Victorian era, like late medieval, early Renaissance, the green was the traditional color of love rather than our modern sense of like red and pink. You know what I mean?
Oh, all right. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's just
that. I thought it was more to represent royalty and status, but
yeah, that tends to be more purple, and purple was even there in the ancient times with Julius Caesar. But anyway, so yeah, I just know that traditionally green is the color of love, and so much so that even in like when Gary Oldman plays Dracula in that movie, like, you know, Mina Parker, they put her in a very green ensemble. So yeah, anyway, so that just, to me, that's just solidifying like her status as this sort of, you know, the picture of like the maiden, you know, Maid Marian, you know, typical princess of, or noble lady of Arthurian legend.
And then she says, you know, she goes to this, she makes my eyes just roll when she gets to the tourney. It's like, she says, it is better than the songs. And it's like, people are going to fight here, you idiot.
It's, you know, her whole deal with like the songs and her fantasies and stuff, you know, I definitely, as a young girl or adolescent and even young woman, had to go through the painful reality of things are not like the books and are not like the movies. And you know, I feel like all women have to go through that because our society wants to perpetuate these, you know, mythologies.
Yeah, no, that, and that's completely fine. But she's just like, does she not know what a tourney is? That people actually go there and fight, and you know, some people might die. And she's just there like, oh, it's better than the songs. And it's like, does she not understand that?
I
don't know. I can't cast my mind back to when I was 11. Did I ever tell you that I have no memories of when I was younger?
Not particularly, no.
Yeah, no, I have no memories of when I was younger. So it is quite difficult for me to, like, imagine going back to, you know, those times, because I have no recollection of how I felt, how it was. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I wonder if in Sansa's case, it's a situation of just by her naivete of youth thinking that, oh, this is a tournament, that, again, this is a contained, controlled sport. Or that maybe in the North, Ned and maybe the Northerners, like, you know, took the extra time to not kill each other. I don't know.
Or they didn't have time for such foolishness.
That's another thing. Like, you know, I'm not totally on board with certain, like Catelyn says later in like Clash of Kings, like, you know, that, you know, tournaments are just for like faking war. Like my son is out like waging a real war. Like, to me, I think tournaments, you know, have their place. And again, not purely for the spectacle of amusing everyone with violence. I think they are a good practicing, you know, regiment.
Yeah, for sure.
Anyway, so she just goes into this whole spiel of like going through all like the coat of arms and who she recognizes, and going like basically being the commentator. She's basically Ludo Bagman at the Quidditch World Cup.
yeah, give her a microphone, someone.
Yeah, and you know, just going through all that, and her making note of how handsome Beric Dondarrion was, and she just wants to marry him on the spot.
Yeah. Oh my god. She wants to.
And it just makes it extra weird because they made Beric Dondarrion so old in the show.
I know. That's what I was imagining as well when she was talking about that. And I'm like, oh my god, that's a bit weird.
Because he looks, I don't know his actual age of the actor. He looks older than Baelish.
No, yeah, 100%, 100%. I think, or maybe, he just like looks really raggedy as well, you know, with the missing eye and shit like that. But I was wondering, okay, what is your view? Before she says, you know, when she saw Beric Dondarrion, it says here, Jane Paul confessed herself frightened by the look of Jala Barzo, an exiled prince from the Summer Isles who wore a cape of green and scarlet feathers over skin as dark as night. What was the point in putting that? This girl is scared of a black person. What was the point?
Yeah, well, it depends on if you're a person who penalizes an author for, you know, making note or highlighting certain elements of racism, because, you know, a lot of people have pointed to this line, particularly with George R. Martin, and, you know, just thinking, even if Martin wants to create a certain level of realism, there are plenty of situations in Essos, or like with Davos with like the pirates, like there are plenty of other situations with black characters where if we want to show the sense of realism and racism, it's okay to do that, or like it's more timely to do it at that, you know, in those places. But to just throw it in here, you know, again, it rubs some people the wrong way.
I think it's a very odd passage, to be honest, because it doesn't fit in with everything else that's going on beforehand. And also, it doesn't describe anyone else's skin color in, you know, before this bit. So people could have been lots of, you know, different colors, different skin colors, but they would have, people might have had different skin colors, but it wasn't mentioned. And then like this bit just seems so out of this passage just seems so out of place.
Yeah, it's I interpret it as maybe not executed in the best way, but just showing the, you know, level of racism in this society. Again, I'm not saying it's executed well, but I think that is supposed to be the point.
No, it makes sense. And you know, there have been some cases, I'm sure, over there as well in the US. There are some people that live up north here that I know this from firsthand because I used to have a friend in university who he lived in, I think it was Carlisle, and he came down to Birmingham to study. And he has never seen a person of color before. Mm-hmm.
Ever.
And ever before that. That's what he said anyway. I understand that. It's just I think that, there is a time and place to have put that sentence in. And it's not there. It's not.
Yeah. And again, to be a devil's advocate, just my experience with being in an interracial couple with a darker skinned Persian man, there was an instance where we drove out, you know, 30 minutes to a cute little artsy town. And again, just small town in the Midwest, even smaller than where I am in Indiana. And they, in the ice cream parlor, they just stared at us. And
wow.
So there is something to be said that, you know, there is something, you know, maybe possibly worthwhile in, you know, Sansa and Jane Poole are, you know, on the surface portrayed as these very innocent, you know, happy little children, but, you know, they still have, you know, deep foibles, as we can see that, you know, they're racist.
Yeah. I think, not a deliberate racism, but more of something that they were born with, inherited, they never seen before, and it scared them, which is very weird. But there's a passage here, so you know, the Hound entered and Lord Renly as well, and then the Stark people came in, so Jorin, Allen, and Harwin wrote for Winterfell and North, and then Septa Mordaine says, Jory looks like a beggar among these others. Septa Mordaine sniffed when he appeared. Sansa could only agree. So this is like, they just have like they no pride for their own knights, and no contempt. They have like contempt for them and like comparing them to other people. And like Septa Mordaine is, you see where Sansa also takes, you know, some of her opinions wrong, because Septa Mordaine is also just belittling the North.
Yeah, and it's, as someone who is a fashionista, you know, I get, you know, it does sometimes irritate me when people purely look at clothing as a sign of socioeconomic status, you know, whereas, you know, like in modern times, like with charity shops and things like that, you, like, I have accumulated a very, I'm very proud of my very fashionable professional wardrobe, and a lot of stuff, like I get my blouses for like $5 and like my pencil skirts for like nothing. So, you know, but in this specific context, is it, you know, I'm a modern audience, like is it realistic in a medieval setting to be able to say that, you know, just because, you know, I assume in this sort of medieval context that the link between like the type of clothes you wear and your socioeconomic status is substantially more, you know, intricate and interwoven, whereas there's more like sort of, and I guess in a way modern times, more social mobility in your wardrobe or being able to present a certain image without necessarily a lot of resources. But I don't think that's the case here, so
No, because, you know, it would make sense for you know, a person from the audience to be a spectator to be making those comments. But, you know, Septa Mordaine knows these people. The, you know, she knows Jory, she knows the Stark's bannermen and their ability. Instead of being excited like you would to be like, oh, look at them fighting in this really prestigious event, they're just like, oh yeah, he looks like a beggar compared to the other ones. It's just like, that's really shitty.
Yeah, I was just watching a like a YouTube video from, that's one of my favorite channels, The Take. They do a lot of analysis of media and books, and they were going into like the Mean Girl trio and the fact, and, you know, discussing how, you know, we like to villainize and demonize, you know, this sort of mean girl trio, when in reality they're just, you know, mimicking learned behaviors of realizing that both outside high school, both in and outside of high school, this is how the real world works, and people attach power to these external resources.
Sorry.
But anyway, I highly recommend it. It's very good. It was like connecting like the three mean girl trio with like classics in literature, like the three witches in Macbeth and like the three fates in Greek mythology. So it was very interesting. Yeah, I strongly encourage everyone to go see it.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I'll definitely see it.
Yep. And then again, more the thing that kind of put me off with Sansa again, because I'm very much the type of that to completely shit on Sansa is a little bit sexist in its own way. You know, to just completely dismiss her and be like Team Arya all the way. But here, even for me, it doesn't sit well just how much Sansa doesn't have a reaction to the guy dying in front of her.
First of all, she says that Jane is, you know, is a bit of a pussy because, you know, when a person fell, she was just like, you know, Sansa was made of sterner stuff. And she didn't look away from when people fell. And then, yes, some person just died. And Jane Paul was, like, crying. And she's like, Sansa sat with her hands folded in her lap, watching with strange fascination. The young knight in blue cloak was nothing to her. Some stranger from the Vale of Arryn, whose name she had forgotten as soon as she heard it. And I was just thinking, is she some sort of psychopath?
Like, literally, it does give up sort of that, like, total, like, lack of empathy. It's like, is she a sociopath? Yeah,
exactly. You know, but then I was thinking, you know, maybe with every sort of, like, tragedy, even though nothing really traumatic happened to her, but, like, Lady dying, she just... you know, we she's learning to be like,
yeah, stone faced.
Yeah, stone face and guarded. But it's this bit where it says, you know, watching with strange fascination that didn't sit well with me.
Yeah, and I think it also is, you know, in some instances you may think that you may see a very extreme traumatic situation and you may just scream, but a lot of times you may just freeze because you just, your brain just doesn't know how to process it.
Yeah, yeah, but like she wasn't freezing, and that's the thing. She was just like very much assessing the whole situation. You know, she was just like, you know, his cloak was blue, but then he got covered in blood, and
yeah, and it's just, you know, weird. Yeah, she goes from a psychopath, but again, feeling empathetic that, you know, Sansa realized there would be no songs for him. That was sad.
Yeah, I don't think she was very empathetic. I read that as like, oh, that's sad.
Yeah, like, you know, so sad. Anyway.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly it. Because he went, you know, after they carried the body, a boy with a spade went onto the field. So she just like moved along after this incident. She's like, Sir Balin Swan also fell to Gregor. So, you know, she's just taking notice of other things. She's not lingering on that. So that's why it made me think like it was very, oh, that's sad for him. Anyway, moving on.
Yeah. But let's see. In the end, it came down to the Hound, Gregor, Jaime Lannister, and Ser Loras Tyrell. And, you know, forget Beric Dondarrion. You know, Loras Tyrell is her heartthrob now. And in the creepy bit with Littlefinger.
Yeah, well, Ser Loras Tyrell gave her a flower.
Yes.
I think he gave all the people, other women, like white flowers, but for her, he gives her
the red rose.
The red rose, yes, yes. And so she's just like, oh yeah, he's so pretty.
Yeah, sweet lady, he said, no victory is half so beautiful as you.
Yeah, and now she's swooning. But yeah, you know, as he rides off, she looked up and this creepy man just staring at her.
Yeah. I don't know. Loras with his flower. I would much prefer Khal Drogo and his declarations of burning shit to the ground.
Yes. 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 When, you know, in that bit of Game of Thrones, when he, I think when someone tried to kill Daenerys and their unborn children, and he found out that it was someone from King's Landing, and he said he goes on into this like massive
monologue
where he's just like, we're gonna destroy every person wearing armor, and we're gonna burn their castles down. I'm gonna give it to my son, blah blah blah. I love that.
Yeah, no, it's because, oh, what was I gonna say? There are a lot of memes of that of that scene with Khal Drogo, where it's like they put in funny things in his declarations, like, I will make them step on Legos. Like some stupid things like that.
I love that. Yeah.
But no, anyway,
Khal Drogo for me all the way. Loras can keep his little flowers. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Littlefinger and Sansa. It's like, you have the Tully look, and
it's like, mother, he says, you must be one of her daughters. Ugh, gross.
Your mother was my queen of beauty once, the man said quietly.
You have her hair, and then his fingers brushed against her cheek as he stroked one auburn lock. He is so disgusting. She doesn't even know him. She doesn't even know him. That is like harassment.
Yeah, it's creepy, and it's just interesting, this sort of, you know, with, you know, I don't know their precise definitions or distinctions between like sociopath and psychopath, but the fact that clearly, like, he is socially inept in a way that indicates that sort of, you know, something pathologically wrong, that he can't like read cues and like things like that. But he can read enough cues like to be able to play the Game of Thrones in the small council. So, but yeah, it's
weird. Yeah. When it comes to the Tully, to one Tully in particular, he just can't keep his chill.
Yeah. But then the moon was well up and the crowd was tired, so the king decreed that the last three matches would be fought the next morning, and it's a big banquet with lots of food. Mm-hmm. And tables and benches been raised outside the pavilions, piled high with sweetgrass and strawberries and fresh baked bread.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was interested in this whole deal with Prince Joffrey. Okay, well, mm-hmm. first Sansa's like, at first she thought she hated him for what they'd done to Lady, but after Sansa had wept her eyes dry, she told herself it had nothing to do, not been Joffrey's doing, not truly. The queen had done it. She was the one to hate, her and Arya. Nothing bad would have happened except for Arya. So
I hated this bit. I hated it. I literally put in my notes, like, this bitch. Because, like, she knows the truth. She was right there. Why is she blaming Arya when, you know, he was the one who, like, Joffrey was the one who went up to them?
Yeah, I chalk this up to a functional blindness that I think a lot of women and men in domestic abusive situations try to rationalize things to themselves to make it less, because again, Sansa is betrothed to Joffrey, like, what is, like, your brain cannot process that I'm married to a monster, so you go, you know, you search for anything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like some of her consciousness is trying to come through when she says, at first, she thought she hated him.
Yeah, like for me, I take it as a lot of Sansa's denial is a level of psychological self-preservation because the reality is so horrible.
Mm-hmm.
Which, again, she can't finally be broken from that. Not even Lady could, you know, break her that. Only when they finally kill Ned does it sink in.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, I mean, you know, she betrays him and everything.
And so she cannot hate Joffrey. I'm just curious, why is Joffrey putting in the effort this time? Or is he really, and this is just her pulling stuff out of her fantasies?
That's the thing, it's just very weird. I think it's just to save face. Because he's in front of a bunch of people. So he's just, you know, he's just... Oh, and because... Actually, I think it's because, you know, more to for his father's, you know, sake. To be like, oh, look how much I like this girl. But then when his father, you know, is completely drunk. Yeah. He doesn't storm. I think it's Cersei that storms off. But he's just, like, completely drunk.
Mm-hmm.
Joffrey just completely switches. So he's like, oh, he doesn't have his dad's eyes on... Mm-hmm. on him, then he can switch. So I think it's just like he's literally just faking it in front of
him. Yeah, like, definitely.
I am not a horrible person.
Yeah, it's just interesting to try and attempt to figure out, like, what are the things that, okay, you know, this is worth my time to put on the face, and in this instance, it's not worth it to put on a face, and just trying to figure out, like, what are the things that make him be like, okay, I have to go through the motions, because he certainly wasn't doing crap in Winterfell.
Yeah. But, you know, he does have something wrong in his head, of course, because of all the incest. So you never know. He's one of those that will just switch.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
But, yeah. And so, what goes on? And Before the end, King Robert had grown louder with each chorus. From the time to time, Sansa could hear him laughing or roaring a command. And ultimately, it's, you do not tell me what to do, woman, he screamed at Queen Cersei. I am king here, do you understand? I rule thee, and if I say that I will fight tomorrow, I will fight.
Yeah, everyone was just, like, quiet.
Like, awkward.
Staring. Oh, that makes me feel ill.
Yeah, I used to work for a get-up setup where my supervisor, you know, and his wife worked together. And, you know, having to be there for, like, business that were also lover spats. And it's just like,
Oh, my God, that's awful. Oh, that makes me feel actually ill. Yeah. Ill.
So just think.
I hate people having arguments in front of me. Absolutely hate it. It's a thing from childhood, but yeah.
Oh, yeah, I hate it too. And, so yeah, just the king and queen having a spat in front of everyone.
Oh, that is so weird. Yeah.
Yeah.
She left, and then you know, Jaime's just, like, putting a hand on the king's shoulder, but the king shoved him hard. And then like, the king says, you know, the great knight, I can still knock you in the dirt. Remember that, Kingslayer. And then like Jaime just walks off.
And of all people to call Jaime the Kingslayer, Robert directly benefited from Jaime killing King Aerys. And so Robert started a whole war to exterminate the Targaryens. And so he's still going to hold it against him, of all people, hold it against Jaime.
I know. And especially when he doesn't blame him. I think it's just to humiliate him.
Yeah.
Really? It's nothing to do with, you know, just being like ungrateful for what he did. But he knows that the name humiliates him. So
yeah, he does it. I think, yeah, if Jaime was not particularly a Lannister, like, he wouldn't do this. Like, yeah, again, it's the same thing. It's like the way certain children feel with their parents. Like, you're in debt because they're indebted to you, they should be grateful. But if anything, being so indebted to someone makes one person resentful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And Sansa's disappointed because Joffrey will not take the time to escort her back to the castle himself, but calls Sandor Clegane the Hound.
He laughs at her because he's like, oh, you think Joffrey was going to take you himself? It's like, it's stupid.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, what was your thoughts, the interaction between Sansa and Sandor?
It really humanized him, and I think it made her less scared of him for that.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a nod, not friendship, but sort of is a nod understanding between both of them.
And what I got out of it is, you know, through their dialogue and interaction, that, you know, on the one hand, the Hound criticizes Sansa for being so like ladylike and, you know, again, going through the motions of keeping up appearances and things like that. But at the same time, I think he has a grudging respect for her for being able to pull that off in a way that he just never could and never will.
Yeah. And that particularly irritates him because he can't do that. He can't, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because when she pulls out, like, you know, did you think my brother was so gallant when he, like, you know, skewered that kid from the veil? And all she says is, no one could withstand him, and he laughs.
He was like, that's the truth enough.
So there is this interesting relationship that will continue to develop. Because, like, in, like, a good chunk of Clash of Kings, nearly every Sansa chapter in a Clash of Kings has a Hound interaction. Almost all of them.
Yeah. Before the Hound goes off, but
before the Hound goes away, which was very sad.
That
just made me think of the actor who played the Hound, you know, when he finally leaves, you know, at Blackwater, and he leaves Sansa, and the actor had not, like, looked at himself, like, in the mirror, like, that day.
And he took a look
at himself, like, his normal makeup and all the blood and stuff from the battle, and he's like, oh, I'm no wonder she didn't come with me, I look terrifying.
You know what? He's such a gentle giant. He's so lovely in real life.
Yep. So
I mean, look, not like I know him in real life, but from watching interviews and stuff.
Yep. And yeah. So I'm assuming he only spills his guts right now is because he must be really drunk.
Oh yeah, definitely. He's saying drunken eyes, sullen with anger. She describes him. So yeah, you know, he's drunk and he tells her, you know, look at me, and just, like, grabs her face.
Mm-hmm.
And she cries because he's so ugly. Bless him.
Yeah.
And then,
most of them.
He starts telling the story of how he got these scars.
Yeah. Most of them think it was some battle, a siege, a burning tower, an enemy with a torch. One fool asked if it was dragon's breath.
Mm-hmm.
And it's. So we get this, you know. And, you know, my first reading, you know, very literally comparing. So in the TV show, we don't get this. We get we get Baelish telling, whispering this story to Sansa, mm-hmm. not the Hound telling him himself. And then this confession we get when the Hound and Arya are together.
Yeah.
You know, so changing of pace, changing of timing in terms of, you know, in terms of relaying this story. And so when, when I realized, oh, that we get this really early and the Hound tells Sansa himself, and I'm just like, oh, mm-hmm. that's interesting.
Yeah, it's to establish that closeness between the Hound and Sansa that I don't think the TV show wanted them to have that in the show. So, you know, which makes me think there might be some more, even though like he leaves in the books, that he might come back for Sansa at some point. Somewhere.
Yeah, so
wherever she is.
So we get the horrible, horrible tale that Gregor just shoved his face in the fire just for playing with his toy. A toy that, you know, Gregor didn't even care about.
So he was only, he was only 6 or 7 years old. But, you know, Gregor is 5 years older than him, and was already a squire. So he was about 6 years old, not 6 years old, what?
Like 13.
He was 11 years old, if mm-hmm. 12 or 13, yeah. And so he got a little knight and a wooden knight, and Sandor wanted to play with it.
Just shoved his face in, and in my personal opinion, I feel it was less about, you know, it's less about the person who directly did the terrible thing, because, mm-hmm. You know, that you can just say they're a psycho or whatever. It's more the people around him who placate and cover up things. So I think maybe for the Hound, it was worse that his father just, you know, told everyone that his bedding caught fire and, like, didn't mm-hmm. hold his brother accountable in any way, shape, or form. Not only didn't hold him accountable, but that fact that an element of Gregor's success in becoming a knight and and getting into the service of the Lannisters is precisely because he is so cruel.
And then it says Gregor got his ointment too. 4 years later, they anointed him with the 7 oils and he recited his knightly vows. And Rhaegar Targaryen tapped him on the shoulder and said, "Arise, Sir Gregor." It's just really sad.
Yeah, it's,
you know, and Sansa goes like, he was no true knight. He says, no, little bird, he was no true knight.
Yeah, and
he's a monster, basically, just a real monster.
He's a real monster, and I thought it was very touching. I forgot that when Sansa feels comfortable enough in the fact that Sandor has shown this vulnerability, that she puts her hand on his shoulder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because she wasn't scared of him anymore. After he revealed that, she just felt sad for him and the fear had gone away. But, mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then rest of the way into the city, they said not a word. And the Hound, like his usual crass self, "If you tell anyone, I'll kill you." Maybe at a later date, I would love to do a scholarly slitter clause about the subversion of the courtly love trope via, whether it's platonic or romantic, with the relationship between Sandor and Sansa, because Sandor is the complete subversion of, he's really crude and brass, but he actively rejects the institution of knighthood because of the hypocrisy of it, even though deep down he actually does more knightly heroic things, like throughout, especially in regards to Sansa.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that's just the interesting notion of, you know, when you realize a institution is corrupt, like, or an organization is corrupt, you know, you battle with yourself of, do you totally reject that institution, or do you join it with the help of trying to reform it to make it a little better? It's like, like, must be like the dilemma certain people in the White House has. Like, do I reject this during the Trump administration? Do I reject this based on principle, or do I help to mitigate the Mad King?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, I think in Sandor's case, he joined it just more for like the benefits that it might come to him. So, you know, being at high court and be able to eat mm-hmm. well and being paid well and, you mm-hmm. know, instead of it, because sometimes it's not just about being a part to try and change the hypocrisy. No. It's about taking advantage of it.
Yeah, like, or again, you know, it's not just, you know, joining for a noble reason. You join it knowing, I know this is screwed up. I'm going to use them as much as they're using me.
Yeah.
But, and thus ends Sansa's chapter.
Mm-hmm.
Alrighty then. Shall we go into history lessons?
Let's do it.
Okay, so my history lesson, I was struggling a little bit. I was just going through like the general notion of tournaments because, again, I just love mm-hmm. the tourney chapter so much, and mm-hmm. especially for its Sansan interaction, but mm-hmm. also just the notion of tournaments. And, you know, I'm fascinated by the notion of like jousting because I rode horses, never got to participate in a joust, sadly. Mm-hmm. But that would have been epic to like knock people yeah. off with a stick.
Yeah.
But well, I would just
try. You could try doing going to the, what's it called? They do the those.
The Renaissance yeah, the fairs. Renaissance yeah, that's. Fair.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I was just reading about, you know, naturally, also in real life in medieval England, tournaments were used to mark very specific events, whether it was coronations or marriages or births or a conquest or a treaty that was signed or, you know, high profile diplomatic gatherings, mm-hmm. like tournaments were used as a marker of, you know, form of entertainment and celebration for all those things. So it's, you know, in that contextually, it's appropriate for, even though they don't have any of the money for it, it's appropriate mm-hmm. for Robert to be hosting a tournament in honor of something as substantial as appointing a new hand to the king.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously for Robert, it was an excuse to get drunk and party.
Yeah.
More, you know.
It was one of the few times.
Acceptable way.
It was one of the times where his desires and his kingly duties for once overlapped.
Yes, yes. That Venn diagram hardly comes around, but it does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I was just, you know, kind of, you know, scrolling through the internet because what the internet says is always true.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
But I did find a cute little article about, like, very significant tourneys in history. Mm-hmm. And so the historical Ulric was a man of considerable importance who at two points in his life decided to show his jousting skill by riding across Germany and Italy, challenging all who would come against him. He was accompanied by many other knights who also sought out Ulric. The distinctive characteristics of these competitions was that Ulric fought in costume. Ulric, his companions, and his audience were influenced by the immensely popular Arthurian literature of that time. In 1227, he dressed as Frau Lady Venus. In 1240, he played King Arthur. These jousts sound like a lot of fun, although they certainly included a great deal of jousting too. And then let's see. The 13th century also saw bigger and better Arthurian-themed productions. They were called round tables and involved many cases, stories more elaborate than Ulric's already impressive production. In 1278, at Hem, a crowd of tourneyers were treated to an Arthurian joust and musical performances by the main parts played by the sponsors and their relatives, the latter including the prominent Count Robert of Artois. It was an event that by and for the regional nobility, their friends and retainers, all the elements came together to define nobility, people who took part in these. 13th century round tables were perhaps as interesting in gaining cultural prestige in real warfare.
Hmm.
And then, yeah, let's see. Ooh, what else we got? Oh, what else? Yeah, in the 15th and 16th centuries, more and more jousts were staged. An example of the spectacle deeds were the deeds organized by Suero de Quiñones, a prominent Castilian knight who took it upon himself to sponsor an elaborate joust. The participants used equipment and armor designed for what was becoming a separate sport. Suero wrote the rules and put his personal stamp on the event by arranging a separate competition for himself and a jousting partner who fought each other according to special rules. He did this without consulting the judges he had hired, which resulted in a prolonged argument about whether these rules could be used. In what must have been the talk of the town, the judges insisted on their authority and Suero was expelled. Finally, Suero sent out his band to play in his support. The judges were not amused and threatened to imprison the musician. After some more negotiations, Suero backed off. So this was something, you know, I think, you know, just from reading those, a lot of people think that, you know, when we put on jousting tournaments at, you know, Renaissance fairs, like that definitely is a sort of stage thing. But from that description, even back in that time, tourneys and jousting and like that sort of stuff, there was a level of theatricality to it, to the point of, yes, we, even though we're living in this time in the 12th and 14th centuries, we are trying to put on this show of Athenian valor and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 Oh, that's great.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, that's mine that I pulled out like 15 minutes before we started recording.
So mine is actually complementing yours. So we have the same mind. Mine is the history. I've researched the history of jousting. And this is from worldhistory.org. So it says here, from the 13th to the 16th century, jousts were a popular part of European medieval tournament, where knights showed off their martial skills by riding against one another with wooden lances in designated areas known as the lists. So it's interesting because isn't A Song of Ice and Fire and Game of Thrones, the book, isn't it set in like the first or second century or something like that?
Like the actual timeline of the,
yeah,
in Westeros, or what it's supposed to equate in our time?
What's supposed to equate in our time?
Oh, I always thought the opposite. From the level of quote-unquote technology and the way it was portrayed in the show, I always took it that Game of Thrones was much more like late medieval, like 13th and 14th century, like literally right before the Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
That, yeah, like, because to me, like the first century, like AD, like, you know, that is considered, I think, like late antiquity, like at least in the American, yeah, the way I'm understanding, at least in the American, you know, educational system, the medieval period starts like 7th or 8th century, mm-hmm, AD.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, anyway, I thought that it was way earlier, that Song of Ice and Fire was set way earlier than 13th century, but well, then it looks like it's very timely. So the two opposing knights were separated by a barrier or tilt. Jousting was an important opportunity for heraldic display, general pageantry, and the chance for a knight to impress aristocratic ladies. Ladies attended jousts, sometimes they even sponsored the tournament itself, and they might give certain token articles known as favors to specific knights they favored, such as a veil, which were then tied around the receiver's lance. So it's interesting in this bit because, you know, in this tournament other tournaments, the knights are the ones who give the ladies something. Mm-hmm. Not the other way around. So I found that very interesting.
Yes, this is very true.
Yeah. The main weapon was the lance, which was around 8 to 10 feet in length and commonly made of ash or cypress. A lance was made hollow so that it shattered without causing too much injury. To further reduce fatalities, lances were fitted with a 3 or 4-pointed head in order to reduce the impact, and swords were blunted. Such weapons became known as arms of courtesy. However, there were also grudge matches where two opponents used lethal weapons and swore to fight until serious injury or death decided the matter.
Yeah. So honestly, so this go. is No, that's good. And I'm just really morbid and ghoulish. But, you know, this whole spectacle of, you know, even not, a, you know, it was intentional with the mountains. But, you know, even just this, you know, sort of accidental death, because naturally you're dealing in sports and spectacle. The horrifying news I woke up to that Alec Baldwin had accidentally shot a cinematographer on the set.
That was
and killed her and has wounded the director. And I'm just like, how do you accidentally do that?
I know. Didn't that happen with Bruce Lee's son in The Crow?
I don't know, but I'm just like, why was it loaded?
It was like with dummy bullets, but dummy bullets can really injure someone still. I mean, obviously, I don't know. I don't know anything about what I've read.
Like, again, I was just horrified, and I'm just like, why was that gun loaded with anything?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nowadays, you can, there's so much special effects that you can put on a film. I know it's a bit pricey, it's a bit more expensive, but it's scary to think that people aren't putting that sort of money to ensure cast and crew safety in films.
Yeah, it's
I just feel really sorry for Alec Baldwin. I know that like not a lot of people like him.
Like I haven't followed,
He apparently was completely distraught, which of course, like when if you accidentally kill someone when you weren't expecting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so we haven't evolved all that much from medieval tourneys. That's the moral. No.
Yeah, no. Well, that's why A Song of Ice and Fire really resonates with people, because even though this is supposed to be set, you know, centuries ago, it's still like the politics and the way that people are really, like, it really matches up to what happens in society nowadays.
Yeah. Hence why the TV show Mad Men was so popular, because even though it's the 60s, all those issues of sexism, especially in the workplace, are still, like, relevant, and us being slaves to masculine and feminine ideals. So let's try to end on a happy note with our friendship lessons. So, my friendship lesson comes from The Hound.
Okay.
And Not the very obvious, you know, make yourself vulnerable or think to your friends or, like, talk to your friends. Mine is more, like, actually a don't do with The Hound, because it's, like, you know, I think it is very sweet and touching that he makes himself vulnerable. But at the same time, he's a drunk, grown-ass man, you know, throwing all of this on a 13-year-old girl. And so I'm just, like, you know, build some rapport with your new friends before, like, dumping all the heavy stuff, man.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
but I mean, who hasn't got drunk and confided in a stranger? Especially though, us girls, we go to the bathroom, we find some girl crying there, and then all of our life stories go out. out.
Oh dear, yes. But anyway, that was my lesson, because, you know, Sansa was very gracious about it, but also I would just be like, what am I supposed to do with this information now?
Yeah.
What was yours?
So mine, I thought it was a really difficult, these set of chapters, to find anything to do
with it was
friendship. So I'm reiterating a few episodes ago, it's again Catelyn, don't do, right? Don't put your friends in danger when you don't have concrete evidence of something. So, like, don't put them in weird positions.
Yeah.
Right?
Or don't inconvenience them unless you know you're really, really right.
Exactly. Thank you. That is precisely it. You know, she's just causing a whole shitstorm. Poor, you know, what's his name is there just being like, oh fuck. That would be my reaction. That's like, not this bitch again.
Yeah, like, you need to have, like, you know, there's that saying, what would Jesus do? Like, yours is, what would Catelyn not do?
Yeah, I live my life thinking, you know, would Catelyn do this? And if she would, I would not do it. I think it's also, here's a bonus, you know, it is a bonus friendship lesson for you. Ooh, don't cause unnecessary drama.
Yes.
Cause unnecessary drama. You know, when I was younger, I caused a lot of unnecessary drama. And tell you what, it's not good. I want to live my life as chill as possible nowadays. But when you cause unnecessary drama, drama will always find you. I'll tell you this.
Yeah, it's, you know, I'm always like, I don't need... There are certain points where someone wants to tell me, like, all the, like, dirt at work. And I'm like, I don't need it. I have a podcast on Game of Thrones for that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So yeah. I don't need it. I get enough of it in books. Like, it's fine. Or I'll write my own if I need drama.
Yeah, I'm going to be a proper white girl right now. But it's like, save your drama for your llama, okay?
Alrighty then, and thus concludes our episode. Tune in next time where we join Eddard, Tyrion, and Arya. And again, I'm just not looking forward to the Tyrion chapters onwards, not because Tyrion isn't cool, but again, I just find this whole dynamic of, you know, Tyrion, Catelyn, and Lysa at the Eyrie to be really, really dumb.
Yeah, you lose a few brain cells with them because you just want to throw the book, especially at the head of Catelyn.
You're more merciful. I wanted to shove Catelyn through the moon door.
Oh yeah, that's good. No, that's a good one. These are very hefty chapters as well, so I think it will be a quite long episode next week.
Yes. Alrighty then, so catch you all next week, guys. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Podcaster's Landing. The music to our intro is copyrighted by Persian-German composer Ramin Djawadi. This podcast is but one of the many shows produced by Sophia Mare Studios. You can get the latest news by following our social media, Sophia Mare Studios on Instagram, Sophia Mare Studios on TikTok, and SophiaMare_pods on Twitter. You can connect with other listeners through the Sophia Mare Studios Discord server. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/SophiaMare Studios. Higher tiers get access to even cooler perks. That was the Sophia Mare Studios podcast.